You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
This week's bits. The best news nuggets from Breakfast and The Wire from this week.
Atamarie, good morning. Kohana Ross Tokuingwa. Welcome to this week's bits. As the election is looming closer and closer with only one more week to go, each week the 95BFM Wire team have been focusing on important issues parties should be focusing on. Last week we focused on economy and this week it was healthcare. To start off, 95BFM's Jack Marshall spoke to the public about their thoughts on our healthcare system.
How do you feel about New Zealand healthcare? Is it good? Is it bad? Would you rate it?
I think that the mental health needs to be improved a lot. And recently Metamore Hospital had like an 8-hour waiting time in the emergency department. So yeah, definitely needs to be improved. And I've heard that a lot of funding's been cut for many different healthcare services. So yeah, change the government!
Compared to what I hear from overseas, the New Zealand health system appears very generous.
So far, being here, my experiences have been good. I've been able to, through my doctors, go to the hospital side of it and been taken care of very well than from where I came from.
I suppose there's always the issue of more funding. I mean, I come from up in Northland, and so there is health issues, but that's mainly due to population density and availability of hospitals, sometimes doctors.
Have you had any experiences with New Zealand healthcare?
I have.
Positive or negative?
I think generally positive. I think any fault is probably on my part for not actually going to the doctor.
What would stop you from going to the doctors?
I just don't have like a regular GP, so it's just more of a pain.
We're quite transient people these days. You don't really stay in the same place, so it's kind of hard to have the same doctor all the time.
Like, I haven't seen my GP for 7 years, dude. My GP is in the Waikato, and I haven't been there in 7 years.
And what do you think the major things we need to focus on in healthcare, upcoming to the election especially?
Yeah, well, of course, it's people living in cars and sick people out at South Auckland. That's the problem.
We've got a growing elderly population.
Absolutely. Well, they're making more old people all the time, aren't they?
Yeah. Do you think something like robots and things play a role in this, or is that futuristic?
That certainly is very futuristic. Again, bots, well, who knows where that one's going to go.
You don't have to pay them, though, eh? That's probably good for the funding side of it.
Yeah, no. Every time I go, they want to charge me $30 to $40 just for, a visit. I mean, if I'm on a minimum wage, I'm 40 hours a week, and I can't afford it. That's the problem.
And can you count to 10 in Māori for me?
Tahirua toru whārema ono whitiwaru iwa te kau.
Shoo!
He then spoke to Ian Powell, the Executive Director of the Association of Salaried Medical Specialists, to get an overview of the current healthcare landscape in New Zealand.
Well, the strength of our public health system is that it's universal. It has a pretty good legislative framework. The District Health Board system, by international standards, is a good system. And I think we do provide we certainly punch above our weight in terms of what we provide for the health dollar. So there is a positive side to our health system, at least at a macro level.
What are the main points you think we need to work on specifically?
Well, I think there are two broad areas. One is that we are underfunded by a significant amount. In real terms, once you take into account population growth, health inflation and other factors, we have lost about $1.5 billion from our from District Health Board funding since 2010. So that's highly significant, and the system has been struggling on the oil of a dirty rag, really, for quite some time, and it's producing its stresses and strains. The second thing is that we have a major failure in leadership, both at a political level and at a District Health Board level. We should be having what we call clinical leadership, where senior doctors and other health professionals are actively involved in decision making beyond their immediate clinical practice, in a way that could actually improve systems quite significantly and improve funding, better value for the health dollar. And we are failing there badly. A third area is the failure in workforce development. Health is an area that's highly labour intensive. Its real value comes from the work that doctors, the dentists, that nurses and many other health professionals do. And yet the workforce is being neglected. It's just expected to do more and more. There is an absence of workforce planning and development in the country, and that is another major deficiency.
I think an important point you touched on just then was this kind of severely underfunded system, because we're hearing all these promises from all the parties saying they're going to invest, you know, $100 million in this sector or that sector, but it's kind of just topping up an already empty tank. So how far behind are we with the funding?
Well, we are, as I said, if we pumped in $1.5 billion now, we would go overnight. We would go some way to correct that. There needs to be a fuller assessment of unmet need, and that's a big unknown factor. We know that there is increasing amounts of unmet need, despite our public hospitals being busier and busier, for a range of reasons, including the ageing of the population, the growing of the population, and the sustained impact of poverty, that the demand on public hospital services is increasing. So we actually need to look at very closely what the funding level should be, not only to keep the system going, but to actually meet the need in the communities where people are suffering poor health, and we need to turn that around.
Just kind of moving on to something like one of the biggest topics this election is mental health. Mm. So I was really wanting to know how we're doing at the moment, and are we moving forward with that?
Well, there is a lot of innovation in mental health by psychiatrists, by psychologists and by nurses and others. That's very, very encouraging. But like other services, mental health is seriously underfunded. But there's also a bit of stigma in respect of mental health that it makes it more difficult to actually get a sharper focus on in terms of funding needs. Having said that, I think that there is a lot of maturity in the public to know that they do value mental health services. And as a result, I think that the public themselves would be acutely aware of the need to better fund our mental health system.
We then also spoke with Green Party leader James Shaw about the Green Party's view on our health and mental health systems.
I think that we certainly need to have a much more comprehensive program around mental health. I mean, we have been calling for a full public inquiry into how we fund and resource mental health services in this country for the last 2 years. My former colleague Kevin Haig really led on that, and I'm frankly flabbergasted that the government hasn't responded, given the statistics that we continue to see. Back in the 1990s, there was a full public inquiry into how we funded the health system at large. It led to significant changes in the way that the health system gets funded, and that's lasted right up until the present day, but it didn't include mental health. And I think that's the thing that we need to do, is we need to take a really good look at it. There are also some things that we know to do and that we can get going on without having to wait for an inquiry, however.
And what are these things?
Well, I mean, it's pretty obvious that making sure that frontline mental health services and counselling are properly resourced. The fact is that at least a third of all young people who get a referral wait at least 3 weeks for their first appointment. And of course, you know, if someone's having a mental health crisis, waiting a minimum of 3 weeks and in some cases 11 weeks is simply unacceptable.
Well, do you think we can afford to just keep pumping money into these services if the systems are maybe failing? Like, do we need to look more into systemic change than just putting money into it?
Well, it's both. I mean, the reason why we struggle to resource this and why the systems aren't functioning as well as they ought to is in large part a function of the amount of money that the government puts into it. And, you know, you have to say, you know, given that we have the highest youth suicide rate in the Western world, it's not really about money, right? And if you're talking a few hundred million dollars, given that the government spends $80 billion a year, you'd have to say that this would be one of those areas where you say, no, this is something that we ought to be funding properly.
Kia ora. And Māori youth are 2.8 more times likely to commit suicide than Pākehā youth, and Pacific youth are 3 times more likely. What can we do to support Māori and Pacifica youth as well with our mental health services?
Yeah, I mean, this is a real tragedy as well. And I think a lot of that comes down to whether we've got culturally appropriate services. And there's some real questions around that. And so one of the things that we need to do is to resource services directly in those communities where, you know, there is a strong cultural basis. And I think that, you know, what I'm seeing is that a lot of Māori and Pacific Island people, young people, feel that when they interact with the health system, that it actually leaves them worse off in many ways because they don't feel that they're being handled appropriately.
We also heard from Māori Party co-leader Marama Fox about her priorities in healthcare.
Well, removing the disparity for Māori in health. Actually, what the national government did is they shut down the Māori arm in the ministry and sent those Māori staff into the different relevant parts of the ministry rather than operating as a collective for Māori issues. And some people liked it and some people hated it. What certainly has been our experience when you mainstream services inside an organisation, when you mainstream staff inside an organisation, and when Labor disbanded Māori Affairs and all those services were mainstreamed back into Housing New Zealand and Ministry of Health and so on and so on, there was a decline of equitable outcomes, not an increase. So we think that all of the mainstreaming of services is rubbish, that you need kaupapa Māori models of practice that work for Māori and for others and for Pacifica. It's just a different way of doing things. It's not just for Māori, but it works for Māori. And so what we've tried to say is, you know, you've got all these health services that are out there, but if they don't have a cultural understanding or know how to speak to the people with dignity and respect, then your health services fail because people don't come to you and you don't go to them.
It so, sounds like you're placing blame on both sides of the spectrum, though. I mean, how are you going to achieve these Māori solutions with a coalition government, do you think?
Well, I mean, it's what we always do. We have to advocate with an independent voice to put those issues in front of the respective ministers and convince them that we're right, because the statistics tell us that we are, actually. And so what we need is someone to have some faith and some willing and some trust that these models of practice work and not be scared off by the xenophobic rhetoric of other parties who don't want any race-based funding or race-based policies. But the point is, if you target services to the group that is of highest need, and that group is predominantly Māori or Pacifica or whatever, then target the services that best suit them. It's not rocket science, and there are those that understand it, there are those who are willing to do it, and then there are those that aren't. And so constantly this has been the battle of Māori for 170 years, for the last 30 years, at least for my entire lifetime, this has constantly been our battle. But we have proven results where we do it right, and so that needs to happen. Can I just also say our smoke-free 2025 goal is real, and we know what is working, but we're getting to the sticky end of people who are still smoking for various reasons who don't want to. When I talk to those people who are still smoking and say to them, why are you smoking or why have you taken it up again after so many years of not, they all tell me the same thing. It is about the stress in their lives and looking for something to relieve that stress, and nicotine certainly does that. We would like to see the steps towards the smoke-free 2025 goal upheld, a roadmap that will take us there of increasing measures over time, not just simply taxing smokers, but also to subsidise vaping, to shift New Zealand from combustible cigarettes into vaping can be done. Because vaping in and of itself doesn't cause cancer or smoking-related illnesses. Yes, some vapes have nicotine in them, and you have different degrees of 2% down to zero. So those people who are transitioning, the vaping is provided through cessation coaches who also work with them about their stress and how they cope with it, then they can have decreasing amounts of nicotine down to zero. And if they do it out of habit and you're puffing on something called grape or pineapple lump and it's got no nicotine, it's just got vaping flavour, then now, you know, there is nothing wrong with that. The habit of having something in your hand, the habit of puffing on something is no longer causing you harmful cancer-causing, you're not sucking that into your body and you're not taking on all of those other things like emphysema, like COPD, like SIDS, like secondhand smoke for kids and cars and on and on and on.
That was this week's Bits. To listen to the full interviews, visit 95bfm.com and check out the BCasts.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/BCasts.